I'm sure he's thrilled to be here. But Tom's done many things at IBM, and we'll focus on the hardware business today. But Tom, maybe you could start out talking a little bit about your background and kind of bring us up to date in terms of where the IBM Corporation is.
Sure. Thank you, Steve. And I'm a lifer, so I've spent 30 and a half years at IBM. I've spent a lot of it in the hardware group, mostly working on software, but in the hardware division, as now called STG. Did spend 10 years in software group. I had the privilege of being the general manager of the WebSphere division, also headed up engineering for both database and WebSphere at 2 points, and spent 1 year, actually 13 months, as head of strategy for IBM before getting this job in April of this year. So I spent the last 6-7 months doing the hardware business, as Steve says. I'm very excited. I've obviously stayed because I've gotten lots of opportunities, and I've seen lots of opportunity for IBM in the past and in the future. And so my commitment there has been about the excitement that I've seen and I continue to see in our possibilities and working with clients around the globe. Have spent a lot of time traveling. I was in China last week, out here in California the week before. I am East Coast based, but my body doesn't know it because I was in Africa 3 weeks ago, and I'm going to be in Europe next week. So I'm all over the world meeting with clients, meeting with business partners, and talking about what we're talking about here today, which is the industry, where we're going and what we're doing, what we're seeing around the confluence of lots of things going on in the industry at the same time around social, mobile, analytics, and cloud, all happening simultaneously, which is a fantastic opportunity for all of us. And so pleased to be here with all of you.
Great, thank you. I did want to take advantage of the fact that you were head of strategy for a period of time. So I guess, how would you describe IBM strategy? It's obviously a very broad business, and yet the company's actually been pretty good, I think, historically, at sort of describing what its differentiation is. So what would you say about that today?
I think that, first off, strategy is always owned by our CEO. So as head of strategy, I really did the work for her. So Ginny really owned the strategy, and I got to work on it. We do it as a combination of unit strategies. So SDG, in my case now, software group, and our services colleagues would do the work. And we would be more of the provocateurs to bring up some of the challenges, some of the issues. We do some of the market intelligence work to see what was going on, some of the competitive work to see what's going on in the industry, really spotting the trends. I thought about it because I'd never been out of the line kind of jobs holding P&L responsibility. It's sort of a prairie dog kind of a role. I got to pop up and really take a look around and see all the different trends in the industry that were going on. So it was enlightening for me personally and professionally. But it is a very rigorous process in that we go through and try to understand the difference between strategy shortcomings and execution shortcomings. So we'll really do a rigorous modeling on those kinds of things, and we really kind of help facilitate around the company as we go through different questions, different issues, different opportunities, and get a sizing for them. The other thing that I got to do for 13 months was sit on our deal committee. As you probably know, we've been very acquisitive over the last 10 years, so getting to see the process, I had gotten to take a few deals forward as a general manager. And now I got to sit on the other side of the table, which is kind of fun, and ask some of the hard questions of the people coming in with their deals and really got a good taste of all the different kinds of deals, different evaluations that we do around our acquisition strategy, which is a part of what we do. We typically bring in strategies into deal committees and say this is an area we think we want to go into, like commerce or analytics. We typically have some kind of an anchor there, some kind of a foothold, and look to adjacent spaces and see what more we can do and then build out around that, either organically or acquisitively, and then evaluate deals one at a time as we go through that. So that's obviously been a big part of what we've been doing in our investment, whether we're doing it organically or acquisitively.
Okay. So let's talk about the hardware business.
Let's go back to strategy.
That was, the 30,000-foot level looks a lot better, but it's not a big percentage of revenue, and historically, therefore, it tends to get a little bit overlooked. Obviously, the strategy of the company is more to be software and services focused in recent decade. But it certainly surprised people this year in that there's been about $1 billion swing in profit, in fact, to a loss. You did, I believe, say on the last conference call that you hope to bring that back to kind of break-even-ish next year. Could you talk about what your kind of near-term and maybe long-term goals are for the profitability of the systems business?
Sure. And let me just clarify, it was $1 billion less profit than it was a year before.
Right.
So we didn't really talk about break-even versus not. Obviously, my job is to stabilize that for next year. Lots of things happening in the hardware business and lots of different trends in the hardware business. A big factor for us has been our traditional growth markets, where we saw 40% decline, predominantly driven by China, by the way. So that was a that was kind of a surprise to us, given that we'd done very well in that same space a year prior. And so big change in a year in the swing. But let me break it down by the different parts of my business that I manage. So mainframe, which is an area that I'm particularly familiar with. I started my career there. We've been very satisfied with what we've done with the current cycle around our EC12, as it's known. The last generation was, let's just call it the 11 for simplicity's sake. It was called the 196. But we've seen the adoption rate of our mainframe around the world be about what we expected it to be. It's very cyclical, goes in the cycles around when we come out with new products. This product we came out with 2 years after the last one. The prior one was 2.5 years. So, you know, some of the compares are a little bit different than they would be a little bit off quarter. But we've seen adoption rates about the same as we would normally see. And what I expect going forward is the same kind of thing we've normally seen, which is a drop-off in the revenue as we wrap around on the compares. But I would point out that we see an increased profitability in that business as we do a lot of upgrades. So you may or may not know this, but I often will ship excess capacity, and then the customer looks to turn that on at some point in the future. Well, I've already paid the freight on that, and now they will pay me to turn on that capacity, and that's a much higher gross profit business, as you might imagine, since I've already paid for it. So it's, you know, much more software-like in the cycle and in the gross profit. Our power business, obviously, is something we need to turn around. We've been doing a fantastic job over the years, and I had the privilege of managing that a couple years ago as well directly in 2010 and 2011. We've been taking a lot of share from our competitors in the traditional Unix space. In fact, since 2006, we've taken about 6,000 clients away from our traditional Unix competitors. So this has been a great play for us in taking share from Unix competitors. And we've been riding that for some time. And we're still doing that, by the way. There's just fewer of them out there to take. But we're doing this. We're gaining share. You've seen us up. The IDC data would say we're up around 60 or 60-plus percent of the Unix marketplace. But we're doing that in a declining market. And so what's been a big change for us, and I announced it in May when I came on board, was the adding on Linux on Power as a new strategy for us. Now, we did this around the mainframe. I made that decision 12 years ago in 2001 to go with Linux on the mainframe, and we've done very well. So we've proven that this can be a very significant play for us. It's not one where we're diverting, we're taking money away from our flagship and moving it on to the new thing, but we have diversified our mainframe business to support both ZOS and Z Linux. Doing the same thing now around Power. So what have we done to confirm that, to make that have some teeth to it? We did several things. We announced a statement of direction back in June around KVM support, so we would support multiple hypervisors. We already support PowerVM, which is our own hypervisor capability. We announced in August the formation of a brand new consortium called OpenPower. Hopefully you got to read about it. It was a combination of Mellanox, NVIDIA, Tian, which is a motherboard manufacturer over in Taiwan, Google, and IBM, all coming together to support the Power architecture. We announced that we would be willing to license the Power architecture to third parties, which is a big deal. More to come in this space as we go out. We'll announce new and exciting new partners into the Open Power Consortium. We got a lot of press on it then. We got some yesterday at the Supercomputer Convention as NVIDIA announced that they would be attaching their GPUs to our Power 8 processor, which is coming next year. We also announced with Altera. Actually, Altera announced yesterday that they would be coding their FPGA support for Power 8 as well and supporting the Open Power Consortium. So that's been an exciting piece of this. We announced five porting centers around the world. Beijing, I visited there in August. Montpellier in France, Tokyo in Japan, New York, and Austin, Texas, as five places where we would be porting industry applications onto the Linux on Power environment. When I was over in Beijing, we'd gotten about 400 done, and there were companies coming in using our facilities, doing their own work, moving their own code onto Linux on Power. Not hard to do, but they do have to go through the process and validate and make sure that it runs appropriately. We've got about 150 products from our software group colleagues that run on Linux on Power already. We'll be doing more in that area, so more to come there. We also announced something called an IFL. If you're familiar with our mainframe business, it's an integrated for Linux engine. It's a Linux-only engine, priced differently. We've done it on the mainframe now for 12 years. We just made it available, I think it was last week. So it was this month we made it available on Power. And we've announced low-end Linux on Power servers, about $6,000 starting price. So really across the board, a lot of initiatives to really focus on Linux on Power. I should have noted that Watson, our Jeopardy winner and now gone commercial, runs on Linux on Power. We talked about it running on Power. We didn't talk a lot about the fact that it was running Linux on Power. It's a great big data solution because of the Power architecture. Talk about that if you'd like as to why Power makes for a great big data architecture, but that's why the research team chose to run Jeopardy, the Watson machine, on Power. If we look at our storage business, I was disappointed as well in our storage performance, and we certainly need to do better there. I think there's some tremendous opportunities, one around our organic investments in something called StoreWise, which is our mid-tier, and we've done double-digit growth there. We also grew our overall storage business in major markets, so we were hurt there by the growth markets as well, not growing in this case. But I'm particularly excited by StoreWise and Flash, and I think the industry should be excited by Flash because it is such a profound change in the storage business. I would argue that Flash today is price competitive with spinning disk and way outperforms what you can do with spinning disk technology. If you look back in the last 10 years in the industry that I have, you know, we've increased processor speed tenfold. We've increased memory bus speed by 20-fold. Network speed's up 100-fold. Spinning disk is up 1.2x where it was 10 years ago. And people will typically dramatically underfill disk in order to get the right performance, to get the right I.O. They don't want to create bottlenecks waiting for data to be read from head, so they underutilize their disk. You can get all this into a flash device, an appliance, if you will, that you can fill up 100%. You don't care where the data goes because it's easy to get to, random access, just like memory. So you're going to get radically better performance at equal or better price, petabyte on a floor tile using less energy than spinning disk does. And, oh, by the way, a lot of things become possible in this world that were impossible before. I was talking earlier to a group of you about this. You know, one example was Sprint. They got 45x better performance in a query they were taking in their call centers. All of a sudden, something is now possible that they can get in a second that may have taken a minute before. Now, all of a sudden, while you're on the phone, I can have a dialogue with you about some opportunity that we may have to do business together. That was not possible before, and if it took a minute or 2 minutes or 3 minutes, it's not going to merit a callback, so we may never have that opportunity. So Flash makes a lot of things possible that weren't possible before. And the last thing I'd say about Flash is people spend a lot of labor, and the IDC data would suggest that 70% of running a data center, the cost is labor. Spreading out that data, smoothing out, making sure that I continue to not have those bottlenecks. With Flash, I don't have to spend the money on the people. I've seen clients go from having to spend 4 months spreading data out to spending 4 hours putting in Flash appliance and getting equal to or better performance. So I'm excited by what Flash brings to the storage industry. And last but not least, if I look at our System X business, it's a very, very competitive price dogfight out there today. So yes, disappointed in what we saw, but not willing to go where others are willing to go. So I want to make sure that, you know, we ride this thing out. I don't think it's sustainable where it is today. So I'd suggest that, you know, we're continuing to make investments in this business. We just came out with two new models, but we'll take it one step at a time.
That's a great rundown. Now, you did mention you were in China recently, and obviously your hardware business was down 40% in China. It was the biggest problem in the emerging markets. And the company's explanation on the call was that it was more related to economic plans in China and hesitation. Since then, Cisco has come out and talked about NSA concerns. What did you find in China, and did it confirm what the company had talked about?
So I was there, as I said, last week, and I was also there in August, and specifically looking for, you know, what's the reasons behind some of this, because we saw it, you know, it didn't just start in the third quarter, although I will point out third quarter last year we were up 19%, so it was a hard compare. That doesn't work with my CEO either, but it was a off a very good growth quarter for us the year prior. But I would say that the evidence I saw was really around the new administration. They just elected the new administration. They had not yet come out with policy. Last week, while I was there, they actually issued the third plenary documents on what their priorities are. A lot of people waiting to see what those priorities would be, whether it was okay to invest in certain areas. And by the way, I don't think this is a light switch now that they published this. They actually came out with more details on Friday. There'll be more details next week and the week after and the month after and first quarter. So I don't think this is a light switch that we're just going to be able to turn right back on. But I do think that what we've seen is most of the problem we've had in China, which is significant, as you say, was significant to my business and to IBM, is this pause that's happening in the industry right now as people wait to see what the priorities are. They weren't sure whether they could make a purchase decision, so procurement was taking a lot longer. They're really thinking about a lot more about the process of going through procurement. So it's a lot different than it was a year prior. And that, to me, was the biggest change. I was looking for evidence of some of these other hypotheses that people have come up with. I did not find it. So, you know, for me, it's really more about change in administration, change in policy, and waiting to understand what those priorities are.
So the hardware businesses are weak. I think there's investor concern that that's going to drag along software and services. I mean, a lot of people still speculate that mainframes with software and services is 25% plus of the company's profit and so forth. To what degree does hardware weakness affect the other businesses?
Well, I think a couple things to note. One is, as we go through cycles in hardware of purchase, some of it is adding capacity, and that certainly could drive more software. But some of it's replacement, and so you may already have a software license for the hardware that you replace, or it may be competitive. When I moved those 6,000 Unix customers over, they already had a license for the software they were running. It ran on Solaris before, now it runs on AIX. So that may or may not have any impact on the software that, because I've just replaced the hardware, or we just updated the hardware, or I've delivered better price performance, so they're getting a better deal on the software than they were getting prior. So, you know, there's a lot of dynamics that go on, whether it's replacement, whether it's competitive replacement, or whether it really is adding capacity. In many cases, people actually have software licenses that allow for more capacity, so that may not drive additional software. So it really depends whether we're adding capacity or not. Second thing I'll tell you is that we've run the company now for many years, and as I said, I spent time as the GM of WebSphere. I ran on 35 platforms. I ran on our biggest growth platform in the early days was Solaris. So we run on anybody's stuff. As long as there's commercial viability out there, we would run. Our number one platform for volume was Windows when I was running the WebSphere business. Now, over time, we moved more of the Solaris licenses to be AIX licenses, but that's just a factor of the competitive nature of Unix. But that didn't change the fact that we run everywhere. Our software runs on Amazon Web Services. Our software runs on our own SoftLayer public cloud infrastructure. It runs everywhere. So I think there's, you know, people are looking for this tie between the two. I think there's a whole lot less tie than people would like to think. So they are truly independent. We don't drive our hardware only with our software, only with our services. If we did, we'd narrow down that pool to be a very small pond, if you will. I'm looking for big oceans of opportunity rather than ponds where all things come together. We do a lot of work with competitive SIs out there. We do a lot of work with GBS, but we'll also do a lot of work with competitive outsourcers or competitive service providers. Do I like it better as an officer of the company when we could do our stuff with our stuff with our stuff? Absolutely. But we've never run the company that way. I wouldn't say we're agnostic, but we're certainly open to running with many different partners, many different software providers. Number one product running on our power processors is Oracle. So obviously we're very open to, you know, whatever the customer happens to want. We want to get our stuff, our hardware in there or our services in there, whatever it might be. So, you know, lots of opportunities for us to run on multiple platforms. I'm not worried about the stack of software and services that runs atop.
How much of the current weakness at IBM, but also industry-wide, do you think is cyclical versus secular, kind of macro issues versus moving into a new cloud era with a different set of decisions?
Well, I think if we look at the cloud to us has always been a matter of a shift and lift. In fact, we declared a couple of years ago that by 2015, cloud would be about $7 billion business, $4 billion of shift and $3 of lift. The lift comes to us in a couple of different ways. So some of my business certainly is shift into private clouds, into public clouds, and I'm selling into both. And then the opportunity there is for lift. So let me talk about a couple things we've done. On the software side, we've moved massively into software as a service. We have 100 offerings out there now that we didn't have before. Some of that is acquisitive. Some of it came in as software as a service. And some we've converted to offer either on-prem traditional licenses or software as a service contracts for people. And so some acquisitive, some we've done ourselves. That enables us to reach all kinds of different markets, whether they be geographic or the size of the company that we didn't have relationships with today that they can now consume and buy online, and also in places we might not have people. But it also reaches buyers that we weren't reaching before, mayors, heads of marketing, heads of HR, not just heads of IT, which is our traditional buyer out there. So it really expands the scope of what we're able to sell and to whom we're able to sell. The second big thing that's happened is we acquired SoftLayer in the summer of this year, which is a huge public cloud provider. It was one that was really unknown prior to our acquisition. Maybe some of you knew about it, but I didn't before we started doing the diligence, which, as I said, I was on the deal committee, so I was looking at it. It was a fantastic find for us, to be honest, to see that, you know, the number one website provider in the world. We host more 270,000 more websites than our closest competitor, Amazon. So, you know, really a lot of good choices out there from SoftLayer, and I'd encourage you to go out to the website and see how long it takes somebody to pop up and offer to help you to find your way through this. It's really self-serve. It really does sell into an SME marketplace, one that we're not that used to selling to. We do have business there, but this is reaching down to a layer that we were not touching before, so it gets us to new markets and new buyers. And you know, the fact that it's self-serve, and you know, you can add to it as you like. We don't have to make a sales call. It's intuitive. It's obvious. That's not necessarily the IBM way. So it was easier for us to do this as an acquisition than it was for us to build it ourselves. We certainly could have done that, but this was a much quicker way to get to that marketplace. So now that we've got the public cloud provider out there, in fact, if you pulled out your iPhone or your Android device, you'd find about half the apps on your device are hosted by SoftLayer. So Yelp and OpenTable, and I don't know how many of you have a Fitbit in the audience. Anybody have a Fitbit? I have a Fitbit. Nobody has a Fitbit. Wow. So you don't get credit for any flights of stairs you've been climbing today. I do. So, you know, those are all hosted on SoftLayer. So it's been a great acquisition for us, one we plan to grow even more.
There's a lot of talk about software-defined servers, networking, storage. I guess you've one-upped everybody with software-defined everything. What do you mean by that, and how is IBM looking to differentiate?
Well, I think, and this is one of the things that I think we've confused the marketplace a little bit. We, not IBM, but the technology firms. When people say I've been doing cloud for a long time, what I really think they've been doing is software-defined compute for a long time. We've been doing virtualization for a long time, a level of provisioning internally, private clouds internally. This is really about virtualization. Why do people do virtualization? The only way to get the usage of a server up is to put multiple workloads on and to virtualize in order to do that. That's the only way to get the consumption model to change. You know, am I using 10% utilization or 20% or 30 or 40? I was just over in China with a client trying to convince them as they go through the Chinese New Year not to run their mainframes above 95% utilization. And the client looked at me and said, I've done it before. Why not? It runs at 95%. I can do it. I don't need any more capacity. I said, yeah, but a little blip here or there, you know, don't you want at least one more engine to make it through to be sure? You know, they may or may not buy because they know they can run this thing at 95 or 100% utilization. That's great for the client. So software-defined compute we've been doing for some time. Certainly the mainframe's been doing it for a long time. We do it on our power processors. Some of my clients run their power servers, the compute virtualization, driven up to 60, 70, 80% utilization. That's terrific for the client to get more out of what they've already purchased. The McKinsey data would tell you that the average server gets 5 to 10% utilization. So we've still got a long way to go as an industry. And that's driven by a lot of zeros about servers that are not doing anything for a long time during the day. If you're driving your mainframe up to 80 or 90%, you're using it 24 hours a day. Power servers at 67, you're using them all day, all night, which is a great value proposition for people. It saves them a lot of money because they get to utilize everything they've already bought. But that's on the compute side, and certainly we partner and compete with VMware, and they've done a lot in the Intel space. On the network, and we heard a little bit of that, and I caught the tail end of the Juniper discussion, and we work closely with them on this. We've been doing a lot with SDN, software-defined networking. That's an underutilized asset, one that if we can get more software definition in there, we can add utilization to the network. Same thing around storage. We've been doing a lot of endorsing of OpenStack. I should say in the network space, we formed Open Daylight as a community to build as an open community and innovate around. Same thing around software-defined storage with OpenStack. We've contributed there. We're a founding member there. And we do an awful lot of contribution of technology there. So we're endorsing these open technologies and innovating on top of those. And I think you'll see that the combination of software-defined storage and networking and compute, which we've been doing for some time, really will give people a lot of both efficiency and agility. because I think software-defined everything is about both of those two things. It's about efficiency, getting utilization as high as I possibly can, and then getting agility that says I want to be able to respond fast, I want to provision something quickly, I want to be able to move workload. Well, that's not easy to do if all I have is software-defined compute, because I got to make sure my network transfers over and my storage is available to me over there when I get there. So if I really want to move work and take advantage of whatever available capacity I have to have that flexibility. The only way to get that flexibility is to have virtualized environments, and that's where software-defined everything. It's really software-defined environments, but I've always said software-defined everything, because I think it's a great way to add that agility and efficiency to the data centers.
Some investors have wondered at this point particularly, why be in hardware at all? I mean, IBM developed from a hardware company to a services-led company to now being more of a software company with half a profit by 2015 being the goal from software. Are there parts of hardware you really think are important to be in? And maybe it does make some sense because of the trend toward converged infrastructure, and perhaps you can talk about Pure Systems as well.
Good point. So let me address the why hardware at all. So while we do support lots of open standards and we support lots of software and on our hardware and other people's hardware for our software, we do have a unique capability to innovate from the silicon to the solution, all the way the entire stack. And so when I can do that level of optimization, it really gives me an advantage. I should have mentioned in software-defined everything, one of the great advantages is workload-aware provisioning, so that it says, I know what this workload looks like, and it would best run on a scale-out x86 environment, so that's where I'll put it. I know this is a big data environment, it would best run on power, so that's where I'm going to put it. So workload-aware systems also give us a great capability, and that's part of what we can do when we have the whole stack from the silicon all the way up to the solution. So I believe it is incredibly relevant for us and an important part of our business. You mentioned converged systems. The reason for that is that 70% number that IDC has come up with. It says that 70% of the work in a data center, the spend in a data center, is spent in labor. It's spent in management and administration, putting on fixes, doing configuration, doing tuning. There's a lot of work involved, and if 70% is the labor, we have a lot of people focused on the 30%, which is the software and hardware spend. Well, we really need to crack the bigger nut, which is the 70% of how much people spend on that part of their environment. And converged systems can give us that capability because we can manage the combination of the compute, the storage, and the network, all managed by software. And so specifically and optimally tuned to the environment it's running. So we will actually want to know in our Pure Systems business what you're running. Is it running an Epic healthcare workload? Is it running an Oracle application? Is it running SAP? Is it running something else? I want to know what that is so that I can specifically take all the best knowledge, the best cases we have of sending people out to do that tuning and actually codify that within what we call a pattern. Now, if I can deploy those patterns on those systems, then I have the optimal setup for that specific workload. And by doing that, we take labor costs out. So if I look at what we're able to do in third quarter, we now are up to 8,000 Pure systems that we've shipped worldwide in over 100 countries. Prior to that, as of second quarter, it was 6,000. I celebrated the one-year anniversary of Pure in May in Bangkok. We're about, let's say, 18 months into this. And so we're up to 8,000 systems. We're actually outgrowing the competition in this space. So, you know, to me, this is a great opportunity for us to take the labor costs out of the equation and allow people to make use of the best of breed knowledge without having to ship an expert in every box.
Financially, I think obviously the street would like to see growth. You know, currency has certainly cut into that significantly. But do you believe IBM is going to see organic growth again in the next couple of years, and what are going to be the key drivers to that?
I'm not gonna actually comment on the specifics of what we'll see in the next couple of years. I'll let our CFO do that. I'll talk about what I'm gonna try to do in the hardware business, which is for next year is actually get stabilized. I think given what we've seen this year, you know, that's a good goal for us to have. So get stability from a profitability standpoint. So, you know, we talked about the mainframe cycle. I get the benefit of the increased gross profit margins on that side. Obviously, we need Power Linux to take off in order to get us into position there. And, you know, we'll have an easier compare, to be quite honest. On the storage business, I think if we can execute around StoreWise and make the deal that I think is available around Flash possible, continue to grow our Pure systems and do what we need to around our System X business, I think we can see that stability for 2014. I'll leave the greater growth of IBM to our CFO.
Speaking of which, you now have a new CFO, or soon will
have. We're about to, yeah.
About to. You did mention that you sat on the deal committee previously in your strategy role. IBM's been very good at identifying excellent technology companies and kind of taking their product and blowing it through your distribution channel. Do you expect that's going to continue to be the approach? Some investors I've talked to suggest, you know, organic growth is really hard to get. There's going to be a lot of consolidation in the industry. Maybe you should just go out there and buy big things.
It's certainly possible for us to go out and do a big buy, big revenue buy, if you will, and just say that would be the quickest way to have revenue growth. That's not traditionally been our style, and the reason for that is it doesn't have the lift that we're looking for because it's a one-time event. It gives us the revenue, but you got to keep doing it, and we're not getting the kind of leverage we're looking for. So when I was on the deal committee, we were looking for really two things. One was going into an adjacent space. So let me give you an example. I mentioned Smarter Commerce earlier today. We had WebSphere Commerce as part of my portfolio. We decided that we saw a great opportunity around what we now call Smarter Commerce. I actually teed this up to the deal committee when I was a general manager. I did 1% of the work. My successor did 99. But I teed up the idea that we could go and start to call on CMOs, chief marketing officers, and actually make a much bigger business than what we had organically around this. And we identified that strategy. And then we identified the different pockets we would need to have a comprehensive story around commerce. And then we went off and actually did a number of acquisitions in that space, Sterling, CoreMetrics, Unica, Demandtech, and others. And we put together a whole Smarter Commerce story. That was a strategy, a place where we had some presence, but we wanted adjacency in these other places. And we, in this case, acquired our way to a much better portfolio than we had prior. So that's a very typical engagement for us because we get a lot of lift there. We have people that already know how to sell this product. Now they can have more in their kit bag. They can get more wallet share from the clients they already have. We did exactly the same thing around analytics. In that case, we did do a big buy with Cognos, but then we built it out with a lot of other smaller buys that actually we did a reverse integration in that case and put the Cognos person in charge of the business internally. And then he went off and did a number of acquisitions that were strategic to fill in the analytics space. We've done the same thing around security. We had a great security organic base. We bought a company. We actually did the reverse integration again, put that person in charge, and now he's gone off and done a string of acquisitions. We put all the organic stuff under him as well. So he had the whole portfolio, and now he's driving the security strategy. But these are all adjacent plays for us in places we were already had a presence. The other thing that we do is try to scale things to worldwide. If you look at our acquisitions over the last 10 years, the vast majority of them have been in North America. I said U.S. before. It's really quite a few have been in Canada as well, so let's broaden it to North America. So we've done these acquisitions of companies that have been largely serving North America as their client base. And if we can blow that out to our worldwide sales force, it gives us another way of doing lift. So I think the lift that we're seeing is either geographically, strategically in a new area, or new buyers by saying we're now going to call on mayors and CMOs and heads of HR and heads of procurement and CFOs as a client versus an approver in the process.
You mentioned CMOs. I think Ginny's talked about IBM having sort of automated the back office. The future is more about automating the front office. Could you talk about your efforts there and the CMO, the chief procurement officer, which perhaps you are in a sense for IBM, are those incremental budgets to the traditional IT budget or not?
We see, especially if you look at CMOs, they're now redirecting their spend into technology. They want to get down to a demographic of one. They want to be able to market to you in the moment where you are in your life, not just physically where you are, but where you are emotionally and where you are growth-wise. Am I getting married? Am I getting a job? Am I moving? Am I having a child? They want to know all these things about you because this could be a great opportunity for me to market to you. And so instead of doing this spray and pray, now they're able to direct their marketing specifically to you in that moment where they have a much better chance of having uptake. And so they're taking their marketing dollars that they previously would have spent on ads and mass ads, and now saying I'm going to be very targeted. So it's different money than the CIO was spending before. It's actually marketing dollars that they're spending in this environment. So I think this is a great opportunity for us to go after, in this case, as I said, a new buyer and a new market. Now, we like to have the CIO and the CMO partner together on these things because frequently he or she will know things that the other one doesn't know. And so bringing them together allows us to leverage the install base that they already have, their legacy installed systems, and the data that they have, the big data that they have, and the needs that the CMO can identify that the CIO may or may not know. So the partnership there can be really important. We're doing more around front office with our clients. We'll use the expression we borrowed from others on systems of engagement versus systems of record. We see the system of record really being this sort of once and only once, stateful environments that need lots of resiliency, typically done on-prem, done with HA and DR and logging and all kinds of things. These are transaction processing environments that I may want to do. Systems of engagement may be done through a mobile device, eventually making it over to a system of record and actually placing an order, but maybe not. Maybe I'm just browsing. I'm looking for a place. I never actually book a table at a restaurant. I never actually move money to my bank. I never actually buy an airline ticket. I'm just doing the browsing part of this. And so this sort of look-to-book ratio is important for a lot of industries, financial services now, as well as the travel companies who are dealing with this issue in spades. Because lots of people like me will spend a lot of time looking and never actually booking a reservation. And that's I'm no revenue to them at all unless they can sell ads for me in some way. So the system of engagement part is a brand-new market opportunity for us. It's where we're helping CMOs, where we're getting a lot of the analytics data. It's a lot of where the social happens. So the social, mobile, and analytics side of this, I think, is really driving the cloud implementation. A lot of the system of engagement will end up in the public cloud environment, which I think will be a great solution for SoftLayer. A lot of the systems of record will stay on-prem due to regulatory environments, privacy reasons, security reasons, and the fact that I want to govern my own machine in that environment.
So perhaps the company's biggest bet is on big data. You've got, I think, the world's largest corporate math department. I see companies like Splunk and so forth with stock charts straight up to the right. And, I don't know those companies well, but I have to think that your depth of expertise just probably blows anybody in the world away in these areas, given what you've invested in analytics and so forth. But are investors going to see this? Are you able to monetize this? Is it early? Is it going to take many years? How do we think that about big data in the context of a very large company?
Well, thanks for recognizing the math department. They don't get enough press these days. I've never been in research, and I've always been impressed by our research team. We've got 3,000 researchers. In fact, we've got 1,000 that do services research alone. So it's not just hardware and software. It's also around services. We've got almost all of them are PhDs. We've got 5 Nobel laureates in our research division. So it's clearly got a lot of talent that they're able to apply. And one of the areas is around analytics. And we've also got a very customer-driven research organization, which was not true 15 years ago, maybe started to turn about 10 years ago. We do a lot of work with research in conjunction with our services colleagues around analytics specifically and understanding clients' data. What can we learn from their data? What patterns do we see? What is now knowable that wasn't knowable before? And so the research team really can play a critical role teaming up with GBS in helping clients understand their data and understand what they can learn from that data. So the math majors in this case, the math department, and the people that really have the smarts and analytics can really go out and help make a difference. A combination of software and services, hopefully running on some of my hardware around the value they get from power and the power we get from the big data solutions. So I think it is something we're going to see lift from. We're seeing it now. We're seeing it around services. We've seen it for a while around our software, both acquisition and the organic parts of it. It's a great opportunity for us going forward in the analytics space, and I think we've only just begun. If you look at most of the predictions of where data is going and the growth of data, we are at the knee of the curve. So we think it's big now. I think it will skyrocket over the next couple of years. And 80% of that data will be unstructured. That's what we're seeing today. I think it'll be true going forward. It's tweets, it's videos, it's all kinds of things that are happening that help us to learn, help CMOs to learn, help other people, help security people to learn about what patterns they're seeing in the data and what they can learn about threats or opportunities. So to me, analytics is a huge upside for the industry and one we absolutely intend to capitalize on in software services and in hardware.
Is Watson part of your business and being, I guess, a piece of hardware, you know, at first? And what's going on there? I guess, you know, the size of the computer has come down. It's now, I think, cloud-enabled. But this seems, again, like something that really only IBM can do, or at least has done so far. When does that become a significant business?
So I did mention that Watson runs on Power, runs on Linux on Power. So it is a part of my business, but it's run by one of my colleagues, Mike Roden in this case, for those of you who know Mike. And yes, we are commercializing Watson. And so for those of you who didn't see, you know, Winning Jeopardy was about learning systems. It was about what we call cognitive computing. So to date, most of what we run, we all run this, are about processing that does if-then-else logic. We do programming of systems. You have to know what you're looking for in order to write the program. Learning systems learn as they go, and they get smarter as they go. They don't think. We're not talking about thinking systems. We're talking about systems that can learn. And Watson is one of those systems. It ingests volumes of information. We've gone after the medical field as one where there's a huge corpus of information. I happen to be married to a doctor. I will tell you she's very good at what's called CME, or continuing medical education. But most doctors spend about 5 hours a month trying to keep up. And just the volume of information that comes out about cholesterol, about diabetes, about whatever it is really hard to keep up with. So Watson, as an advisor to doctors, can really help digest all that information and bring the relevant information in front of the doctor. We're not displacing the doctor. We're augmenting what he or she is able to do and able to see, coming up with a confidence level to say what the diagnosis should be and what the remedy should be in this case. But giving choices and saying, well, you know, maybe this symptom was actually weighted a little higher. You know, they said they have a headache, but they always have a headache. So every time I've seen them, they've had a headache. That's not a new finding. So if that was the big reason why you're highly confident in this diagnosis, then I don't want to rate that as high. Let me mark that down a little bit. So it's an interactive discussion, not like Jeopardy, where it's a quick 3-second answer. So, you know, that's the kind of thing that Watson's able to do in the medical field. We've now, as you pointed out, Steve, done more commercialization around call centers, around anything where there's a large amount of information we need to be able to ingest and learn from and be able to get out there. In this case, making the announcement around making it available in a cloud and making the APIs available to others to build an ecosystem around cloud computing, around Watson. I happened to be in Austin when we announced the commercialization of Watson, and we had several examples up there. One was a travel company that had done a lot of things about saying, you know, if you ever said, I want to go on a romantic vacation with my wife, I want to spend about this much money, and I want to go somewhere with a beach. You know, you do that, you type that into a search engine, and you're going to spend a lot of time searching through a lot of stuff. But if I had somebody who understood natural language and could pick out the key points on there, I could actually come out with travel advice that would really help. In fact, we talked to the guy who was the founder of Kayak, and he said when he books one of those vacations, he calls a travel agent because he actually wants personal advice. That's the kind of thing you could actually deliver with a learning system that actually can ingest all that information, all the different ratings out there, and say, well, romantic, beach, affordable, whatever, you know, these are my choices. Here's my recommendation for where you should go.
We got a couple of minutes. Any questions from investors?
Hey, Tom. Sorry to make a very networking-specific question, but I think you guys were recently at the Cisco and SAMI launch. You're also working and partnering with Juniper. I'm curious, you know, how you sort of see some of the evolution occurring within the context of SDN and the networking landscape and your partnership with each of these major vendors.
So we do have partnership, and we were just catching up at the end of the last conversation. We have partnered with companies around Open Daylight in the networking space. It's a group we formed. We actually contributed an asset there from our research organization. We do come together with these companies around networking because we do see a future in SDN. And I know one of the questions in the last session was how quickly we would see this. I think it really matters. There's a couple different ways this can go. You can map onto existing networks or you can start from scratch. Obviously, starting from scratch is going to take a while, but I think there are ways to map onto existing networks that can drive these numbers higher. And so we're very much in partnerships with the Junipers of the world and others to get and advance this cause. And again, like we typically do, we'll form it around some open consortium and then innovate on top of that. Thank you for the question. We're about out of time. One more?
Any other questions? Okay, maybe I'll ask one more. You kind of surprised the world maybe a decade ago with an endorsement of open source. And kind of went Linux in a way that probably Sun should have, and seemed to make money. Now you're doing sort of the same thing with OpenStack, I guess. How does OpenStack fit into your approach, and where are you going to make money?
You know, it's interesting, Steve, you mentioned it, because I think at the time Linux was a groundbreaking decision for us. It was very different than something we had done before. But as I thought back on it, and you look at the evolution of what we've done, we did the same thing around WebSphere in the late 90s. We actually contributed to Java and endorsed the J2EE standard, endorsed Apache as the organization we'd like to work with. We liked their licensing model, and then we innovated on top of that. When we bought the company called Rational, which was development tooling, we actually contributed a bunch of software called Eclipse to become a developer workbench into a consortium. Actually, last time I checked, run by somebody from Oracle. So, again, really being willing to work with the industry around open consortiums and then innovate on top. As long as it has the right licensing model, as long as it's not dominated by one particular contributor, then it works wonders for us. We did the same thing around Linux. Again, we did not invent it, but we were major contributors to it. We've done the same thing around OpenStack now. So we weren't, you know, the big contributor in this case was Rackspace and NASA, but we've now become major contributors to this space. We did the same thing around Open Daylight. So I think you'll see a lot of places where we've built something at its core and then innovate on top. It's a great way for us to give people choices and then convince customers that we have the best implementation of. Done the same thing around Hadoop, by the way. We've got Hadoop open distribution. We've got Hadoop delivered as part of our Big Insights product that we think is the best implementation thereof. So it's actually a consistent example of the way we operate, is doing it in an open fashion and then innovating on top of that.
Okay. Tom, that was terrific. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. Thanks for your question.